As Keeping Up with the Kardashians fans know, Kourtney is deeply committed to an organic lifestyle. So there she was addressing lawmakers on Capitol Hill last week, advocating for tighter regulations in the beauty industry. We're talking about the legislation called the Personal Care Products Safety Act here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Cheryl Wishover continues to report on this issue as the senior beauty reporter at RACT. It covers shopping and the intersection of politics, fashion, and beauty. Her recent piece is called Cosmetics Regulation is a Joke. Can a Kardashian Fix It? Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So there are these two bills going around the Senate floor to regulate the cosmetics industry more than what it is being regulated now. One bill is from Utah Republican Orrin Hatch. The other is from Dianne Feinstein and co-authored with a Republican, Susan Collins. What would these bills do ultimately?
So ultimately, they would provide the FDA more power to regulate cosmetics than it currently has, is the bottom line. And they do that in different ways.
So let's get into it. Are these bills different from one another? Do they have parallels?
They do have parallels, but they are different in some key ways. So I think the biggest difference is that as it stands right now, and I think this is what surprises people the most, the FDA does not have the power to force a company to issue a recall. You know, if there's a contaminated product or something is not right, the FDA can suggest that that company voluntarily recall a product. And so under these two bills, the Feinstein bill does have that in there, you know, that the FDA will have the power. The Hatch, does not. So that's the biggest difference.
So that the FDA could say, hey, company, you have to stop what you're doing, stop manufacturing this, and take these products off the shelves?
Correct.
So what products are we talking about here? This is not just the cosmetics, the mascara, the eyeliner, and other, you know, lipsticks. This goes broader than that?
Yes. So it includes cosmetics and also personal care items. So that's things like shampoo, soap, hand washes, you know, anything that you basically put on your body that is not sunscreen, essentially, because sunscreen has over-the-counter ingredients that the FDA considers a drug. So those are regulated in a different way. So yeah, anything you use on your body would fall, you know, under the umbrella of these two potential bills.
So including shampoos and deodorant?
Correct.
So this is a pretty large arena, a large area of products.
Yes.
What about toothpaste?
That is a good question. I don't think toothpaste falls under... I don't think toothpaste is a part of this, actually.
So is there some broad bipartisan support for either of these bills?
There seems to be at this point. I mean, Feinstein-Collins has, you know, bipartisan sponsors. As far as what is going on behind the scenes, I'm hearing from sources that there are a lot of discussions and negotiations to sort of... make a bill that all of the sort of stakeholders, which includes, you know, the beauty trade organizations, indie beauty brands, you know, there's a lot of people who have an interest in these bills. So I do think there's bipartisan support, but, you know, we also have an administration that is very interested in deregulating a lot of things. So while I'm hearing that there is optimism that something will be passed, like, who knows? But, you know, I've been covering this for, this bill has been floating around since about 2015. And this is the most support and most momentum I've seen yet behind it. So it seems like something could happen.
Cheryl Wishover is with us. She reports for RACT. She's a senior beauty reporter. We're talking about the Personal Care Products Safety Act. gathering your insights, your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you think cosmetics should be as heavily regulated as food products or even prescription medications? Should new cosmetics and personal care products have to undergo clinical trials to be approved? Do you think personal care products and cosmetics should be FDA approved? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Cheryl, one of the bill's mandates that the FDA study 5 cosmetic chemicals each year, but there are thousands of chemicals that go into these products. So why just 5?
I think probably because it's cost prohibitive. To actually review all the current safety data that we have on all these chemicals, to do new studies, to gather it all up, to do a report, that's going to cost a lot of money. So I think what the bill sponsors were thinking was that, start with 5. I would assume they would start with the 5 sort of most contentious chemicals right now and then go from there. But the Hatch bill doesn't have any sort of requirement for that at all. It just says the FDA can test chemicals, but doesn't sort of mandate it to. So that's another difference between the two bills.
Is there one highly contentious chemical out there that's in a number of products?
Yes. that would be parabens, for sure. I would suspect that would be one of the first categories that, they would look at, assuming this bill passes.
And they're often in our shampoo, is that right?
Yes, they're in everything. They're in perfumes, they're in shampoos, they're in body lotions, they can be in makeup. Basically anything that's water-based can have a paraben in it. Potentially.
And what do parabens do for the product?
So they are preservatives, basically, to make sure that bacteria and fungus don't grow. They keep the products fresh.
It's often cited that Europe has banned 1,300 cosmetic ingredients. I was seeing that number floating around the internet, compared to about a dozen banned ingredients here in the U.S., Why is there such a disparity?
So the EU established their commission, I believe, back in 2003 and came up with all these regulations and updated it in 2013, I believe. They've taken a sort of better safe than sorry approach. So the reality is that for a lot of these chemicals that go into cosmetics, we don't know conclusively that any of them are really going to hurt human beings. Parabens in particular have some evidence in mice and in cell cultures, that they could affect hormone levels. And because ethically you can't test these on humans, you can't bombard humans for 5 years with parabens and see how they react, right? So I think the EU has sort of taken the tack okay, we're just going to ban anything that has any questionable data on it and go from there.
Going back to these bills, there would be more testing of these ingredients. We talk about 5 major cosmetic ingredients like parabens. Who would be paying for this? Who would be footing the bill?
Yeah, so that's another point of contention between these two. So in the Feinstein-Collins bill, the industry, and it's unclear who exactly in the industry, but it sounds like larger companies would put up to $20 million a year to make sure all of this happens. So essentially to be self-funded by the industry. And there are, a lot of, if you're a smaller company and you don't make beyond a certain amount of sales, I don't think you have to pay that. But and then in the Hatch bill, there's just some vague wording as it stands now that congressional appropriations would cover that, but it doesn't say how much. So I think proponents of a Safe Cosmetics Act are a little bit worried that enough money might not be made available.
It sounds like it's not really nailed down about who is essentially doing what or who is required to do what in terms of the cost of trying to do these clinical to do these trials and to do this research.
Yeah, it certainly isn't. And I think there are a lot of frenzied conversations happening.
Legislation in Congress aims to put tighter controls around what goes into cosmetics, into the shampoos we use, into deodorants. It would require companies to disclose their ingredients to the FDA, register the facilities where their products are made, and permit the FDA to insist on warning labels where necessary. We're talking about the state of the cosmetics industry and the regulation of ingredients here on The Morning Show. Senior beauty reporter at RACT, Cheryl Wishover, stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about the ingredients in cosmetics? Should this industry be regulated like food products? Should new cosmetics and personal care products undergo clinical trials? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this news on the Ideas Network. At a time when Washington is pushing to deregulate industry, a congressional effort is underway to intensify federal regulation over cosmetics and personal care products for the first time in 80 years. We're talking about the momentum we're seeing recently behind the Personal Care Products Safety Act. The legislation has 15 co-sponsors to date. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Cheryl Wishover stays with us. She is senior beauty reporter at RACT, which covers fashion and beauty intersecting with politics. Gathering your insights, your questions, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you read labels? Do you think the personal care products and cosmetics should be FDA approved? What are you concerned about when it comes to the shampoo you put in your hair, the deodorant? Call in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Cheryl, the cosmetics industry hasn't really been regulated a lot since the 1930s with the passage of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938. So Senators Feinstein and Collins first introduced their bill, as you mentioned, back in 2015. No traction, nothing ever happened with it. Now, a Kardashian shows up on Capitol Hill last week lobbying for this. Where is this push coming from recently, this momentum here that we've seen?
Well, she was there as a guest of the EWG, which is the Environmental Working Group. You know, they're the nonprofit organization that publishes, you know, the Dirty Dozen, talks a lot about pesticides. So this is something that they've also taken on in the last few years. So they are actually a huge impetus behind this. You know, they have thrown their support behind this bill. Have tried to publicize, you know, everything that's going on. They have something called the Safe Cosmetics Database. So they've been a huge part of it, for sure. That's one. I think, you know, entities like Goop, with, of course, Gwyneth Paltrow behind it, has been very vocal and tried to bring this topic more public awareness. So, you know, very recently, I think those two things for sure have helped to publicize it.
And what is the Safe Cosmetics Database?
It is the EWG basically has gathered up studies on, it's actually called the Skin Deep Cosmetics Database. Apologies for that.
That's okay.
It's gathered up a lot of different ingredients and products and sort of gives them a rating from 1 to 10, with 1 being quote unquote, and I'm putting this in quotes, mm-hmm. safest, and, you know, 10 being, you know, potentially the most dangerous for humans. And it's sort of become the go-to database, for products and ingredients, but, you know, some people do, since there isn't a lot of data, sometimes certain chemicals will receive a quote unquote more dangerous rating, but like the reality is we don't really know. So that's some criticism that they do get from scientists and the cosmetics industry.
So why hasn't anything happened since 1938? Because our cosmetics orbit, the world of things that we put on our bodies has seems to have increased dramatically over the decades. You know, for everything from lash extensions to who knows what anti-aging things going onto our skin.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the reason why the cosmetics industry is, you know, a multi-billion dollar industry. There are so many players now. Also, there have been a few really high profile instances of cosmetics either that are contaminated or that are causing weird adverse reactions. And I think the most publicized one recently is the WEN, W-E-N, hair care. Issue, you know, people were complaining that it was, you know, causing irritation, making their hair fall out, you know, and the FDA got something like a whopping 1300 complaints, which is crazy for them. You know, usually they get, I read a number, something like only 200 complaints a year. So to get 1300 on one product was pretty significant. And, you know, that company actually ended up settling a lawsuit for, I think, $26 million. So that really shone a light, like, okay, you know, what's going on in the industry.
So the FDA really has to wait for these complaints to come in order to act?
Yes. So companies are not required to report to the FDA when they get adverse reaction complaints. You know, it's voluntary, which is something that these bills would change. You know, it would become mandatory that companies report to the FDA when they get these sort of complaints. But yeah, they wait for companies to come to them or consumers.
Anne in Verona emailed and said, I try to shop safe, she says that in quotes, but find that she finds that she's overwhelmed in the aisle, reading label after label. Anne says, I've also tried to use online guides, but that's complicated too. Why is this so hard? I give up. Is there that sentiment out there, Cheryl?
Yes, yes. Because the pure number of products there are and the sheer number of ingredients that go into each product, it is very confusing. And of course, like, you know, the names have these unpronounceable chemical names, and you know, there is a lot of fear mongering too, so it's easy to be afraid of everything and not really know, you know, what is reality and what isn't. So yeah, I mean I sympathize, and I hear that a lot actually.
So what impact do you think Kourtney Kardashian made for lobbying for this legislation last week?
Yeah. I mean, I assume, I don't know this for sure, but I assume the EWG paid her to be there, and it clearly paid off in publicity, because pretty much every lifestyle site, the New York Times, the Washington Post, like everyone covered Kourtney on Capitol Hill, right? So that it, publicity wise, I mean, I think it was huge because this is something the EWG has been hammering home forever, you know, to, so anytime you have a Kardashian, there's going to be a million cameras. So,
well, you can almost hear them in their boardroom. If we need to get a Kardashian on Capitol Hill, well, let's do it.
You know? Yes.
Who knows? Yes. Who knows if that was said? It certainly got our attention. So, but she is also, this particular Kardashian, Kourtney, is very interested, passionate about a natural, organic lifestyle.
Yes, she seems to be. So I have to admit that I have never once seen the show, but I still feel like I know way too much about this family. But yeah, she has been the one who has, you know, if you follow her on Instagram, she's constantly, you know, all of her healthy meals. She talks about organic things. And I think she started getting interested in it when she first had her kids. You know, she was interested in what she was feeding them and putting on them.
Well, so Kourtney Kardashian goes to Capitol Hill. There's a lot of photo ops. She talks. But then at the end of the day, well, where is this legislation?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. You know, it's going to be really challenging because this is a huge industry with thousands of products to wrap our heads around. So, I mean, yeah, it's challenging. And there are a lot of people who have a stake in it. You know, I think the PCPC, excuse me, who is the Patient Care Products Council, and they are the industry's professional group, and you know, they have a lot of lobbying power. I think they're actually interested in getting some kind of legislation out there because they're so tired of hearing in, you know, the mainstream media, like, your products could be killing you, they're toxic. I think they just want to be able to say, like, no, no, we're regulated. You know, people are looking at these ingredients, because it's sort of like, I'm hearing this behind the scenes too, that they really want to be able to tell consumers, no, there is a level of regulation outside of just us regulating ourselves.
Well, let's look at the courts here. You were reporting on Rodan and Fields being sued for some type of lash moisturizer, lash extender. What was that about?
Yes. So so these lash growth serums are really popular right now. You know, people want longer, fuller lashes. They start thinning out as you get older. So, there is a prescription product called Latisse, which you've probably heard of. Mm-hmm. Claire Danes and Brooke Shields, you know, used to advertise for it. And it's a regulated, FDA regulated drug because it has potential side effects. But what happened is that someone discovered a different version of that chemical. It's called a prostaglandin analog, and it's not exactly the same as the one in Latisse, but they started putting it in over-the-counter products. And because cosmetics are not regulated the same way that drugs are, you know, it ended up in all of these over-the-counter products, and people started having complaints that, you know, their eyes were getting swollen shut, you know, they were getting droopy eyelids, all these sort of scary side effects. So it turns out that the Rodan and Fields version, which is Rodan and Fields is one of those MLM companies, you know, sort of like the new Avon. You'll see your friends selling it on Facebook. A lot of people apparently have been complaining about the side effects. So, there's a pending lawsuit.
And so Rodan and Fields, they are a multi-level marketing company, but there are also all of these smaller mom and pop cosmetic companies. How do they work in terms of the products that they put out there and how they're regulated?
You mean how does it work now?
Yeah, they're under the similar guidelines, go ahead.
I mean, anyone can start a cosmetics company and put out cosmetics. They don't have to register with the FDA. They don't have to do anything. I mean, the FDA does have some regulatory power. So, and this has actually been a point of contention with similar products to the Rodan and Fields. They can regulate what kind of claims products make on packaging, right? So if a company is saying this product will make you grow eyelashes, that's technically illegal. They can say this will, you know, help condition your eyelashes. You have to be very vague on cosmetics packaging. So that is actually an area where companies do get in trouble sometimes with the FDA if they make claims going above and beyond, you know, very vague things. They can't say they can cure or fix anything, basically.
We're talking with senior beauty reporter from RACT, Cheryl Wishover. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you stick to buying natural or organic makeup, shampoo, lotion, other personal products because you're concerned about chemicals found in non-natural products? What about ingredients in kids' makeup? Are you concerned there? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Cheryl, are there brands you can simply count on to be safe, or do you really have to shop product by product these days?
Yeah, I mean, technically, no, you can't assume any brand is safe because any company can tell you anything about their brand and product. So the word natural, it means absolutely nothing. It's not regulated. It's not recognized by the FDA. So, you know, to be you know, to be really dramatic, no, you can't trust anyone. And like I said, like I'm sort of the school of thought that I don't think every beauty product is going to kill you, but I do think the industry should have more regulation. So, I mean, with that being said, there are retailers who sort of vet their brands and have lists of ingredients that they consider no-gos. So there's one store called Credo, C-R-E-D-O, and it does have a national website and stores mostly on the coast right now. But they are sort of known as the Sephora of clean beauty. Clean is the other word that is not regulated. But, you know, if you're concerned, you can shop places like that. But really, really, there's no way to know, because even a natural, quote unquote, natural company can say, oh, yes, but like, who knows what's in there? No one knows.
Let's go to Mary joining us from Pewaukee. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I think you just kind of touched on it. I had just posted something on Facebook because I read through one of these health pharmacy something about a carcinogen that is now being used or has been used in products, including, you know, for baby shampoos. So I'm sure, I think that's a huge point, is we don't know what these chemicals are that we're actually using. So you can DIY, do it yourself.
Mary, do you do DIY on your personal care products?
No, I don't, but I'm going to start. I really wasn't quite aware of the, you know, the dangers.
Yeah.
I read this article.
Mary, thank you so much for the call. Cheryl, what do we know about the ingredients in baby products?
Yeah, so Johnson & Johnson got into trouble a few years ago because there was a chemical, it's not formaldehyde, but when the product is used, it releases a little bit of formaldehyde, which of course, as you can imagine, sounds bad. Like, why, you don't want to put formaldehyde on your baby's, you know, head, obviously. But they're regulated the exact same way as every other cosmetic out there. So I'm actually seeing there's huge industry now, the same way it's happening in the general market. There's a huge industry for baby brands. You know, I'm seeing a lot of, you know, so-called clean, you know, small indie brands popping up. So I think that's something, I don't think it's going to be regulated any differently. But clearly, you know, consumers are concerned.
There's also been concern about kids' makeup for younger kids. What do we know there?
Yeah, so a year or two ago, Claire's, you know, the little boutique that sells, you know, makeup and hair bows and stuff, they, I believe it was a TV station actually that investigated some kids' makeup products and found they were contaminated with asbestos, which is obviously very concerning. So, you know, that led to, I mean, it's just one more data point for why we need more regulation and sort of how that's happening. It's just sort of one more, you know, nail in the coffin, I guess.
We've seen momentum growing on both sides of the aisle in the Senate to stiffen oversight of safety standards for beauty products, including skin creams, deodorants, hair dyes, shampoo, and mascara, which until now have only been lightly regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. Consumer safety groups are seeing this moment. Kourtney Kardashian was on the Hill last week advocating for tighter regulation in favor of the Personal Care Products Safety Act. We're talking with the senior beauty reporter from RACT, Cheryl Wishover, about this. You can join in with your questions, your experiences, your approach to these cosmetics. 800-642-1234. Do you go the do-it-yourself route, or do you stick to buying natural or organic makeup? What are your concerns? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. The cosmetics industry has faced growing pressure from retailers and consumers to make sure products are free from risky or unknown ingredients. Things like lead, things like formaldehyde, in recent times, even asbestos, they've surfaced as an issue. We're talking about the Personal Care Products Safety Act, what it is, what it does, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The senior beauty writer for Racked, Cheryl Wishover, is our guide. Getting your questions and perspectives, they're welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you think personal care products and cosmetics should be FDA approved? Do you think there is an overreaction, an overcorrection going on here to clamp down on ingredients? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Heather, who's waiting in Madison. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question is, with all this push for, organic living style, more people have turned to oils and natural products. Are they thinking about in this bill to kind of bring that up to? As far as, I'm a mom of two girls who tries to find products that are natural. So I use a lot of like coconut oil and jojoba oil and vitamin E. Has anyone touched on that part just to control so nothing can be altered?
Right. And essential oils as well in the mix there. Cheryl, what about oils?
I think if it's an ingredient in a personal care product, it'd fall under the same potential regulatory guidelines that anything else would. If it's an ingredient on an ingredient list, it would be subject to the same scrutiny, whatever scrutiny that is going to be. Essential oils they can be very active substances. They can have side effects in a certain percentage of people. So I think it's important to note too that just because something is quote unquote natural does not necessarily mean it is safe either. So it's so tricky. Like, it can be terrifying and, to walk into a store and try to figure out what to buy. But yeah, I think it would be subject to the same.
Impact. So Cheryl, there was such a growing momentum in the 80s and the 90s to get away from animal testing. And you would see on the labels, and you still see on labels today, never tested on animals. Where are we at with that? Because couldn't we know more about these products if they were susceptible to animal testing?
Yeah, so there is another this is another huge push in the cosmetics industry away from animal testing, because it is cruel, and the technology is getting better and better to be able to test products without using animals, and really most of the major companies don't do animal testing to sell in the U.S. However, if they sell their products in China, which so many American companies do because it's obviously a huge market, China still does have animal testing requirements. So a lot of companies, I'm thinking of, just to name check one, MAC Cosmetics, of course, huge makeup brand. They get a lot of pushback from their fans because they sell in China and so have to, subject their products to animal testing. But I think we're definitely going away from that. You're not going to see more. You're going to see much less, going forward, for sure.
Let's go to Josh joining us from Oak Creek. Hi, Josh.
Hello there.
Go ahead.
Interesting topic. The only comment I have is that the basis of all makeup is going to have hopefully some sort of natural base to it. But with this regulation, my wonder is, on top of that natural base, it's going to be filled with chemicals anyway. And I don't want to hear asbestos and everything else in them like anyone else, but how far does the regulation go considering every piece of makeup has got chemicals in it that more than likely combined are doing something to us that we don't want done? And I'll take you guys can comment on it.
Josh, thanks for that. So Cheryl, as Josh says, every chemical makes an impact.
Yeah, I think what is important, first of all, is that there is a lot of chemophobia out there. So just saying the word chemical doesn't mean it's bad. There are, even natural, quote unquote, I feel like I have to keep saying natural in quotes because it doesn't mean anything, are chemicals, right? They have a chemical structure. They can be active ingredients. So I think, first of all, getting away from thinking synthetic chemicals are bad is one way to sort of start thinking about this whole topic rationally. But yes, I mean, I think that's what this potential regulation is hoping to at least start providing a framework, because that doesn't exist. And it's impossible, though, to know how, because, you know, every product has their own, patented formulas. So it's going to be impossible to know how every single ingredient interacts in every single concentration that it exists in. You know, it's a challenging issue for sure.
Cheryl, the Personal Care Products Council, the professional group representing cosmetic companies, they put out a statement late last year praising both of these bills that are circulating. Why is there so little resistance to reform from within the industry?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, I think they're in the space that I write in the sort of fashion and beauty space, there is a lot of chatter about toxicity. You know, is this toxic? And you have Gwyneth Paltrow giving a lot of, you know, sort of scary statements, you know, stop using these products. And I think the industry is really, really is welcoming some legislation. But I also think they realize that this isn't going to be it isn't going to be clamping down on them and preventing them from selling products and making money, to be totally cynical about it. You know, they'll be able to say, yes, we're regulated, and hopefully that's giving consumers a little bit more peace of mind.
Cheryl, as we wrap up here very quickly, do you think that we'll see this legislation get through? What are you watching?
I actually do think it will get through. I think it's going to be a different bill or different bills, I guess, as they both are. But there are conversations happening. You know, I've heard something could, you know, hit the floor as soon as May. That might be an aggressive timeline, but I think something will at least go to a vote this year in 2018.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Cheryl Wishover is senior beauty reporter at RACT. Her piece about potential regulation of the cosmetics industry is called Cosmetics Regulation is a Joke. Can a Kardashian fix it? 50 years ago today, Milwaukee adopted its own open housing ordinance. That move came more than 2 weeks after President Lyndon Johnson signed the Federal Fair Housing Act. The law bars discrimination based on factors like race, sex, or religion. But some area housing advocates argue that there are loopholes in the federal and Milwaukee laws. As Jimena Condi reports, some Milwaukee County officials are trying to close one.
Chandra Williams is looking for a recent picture of her son, Wilbert McDonald, in her 3-bedroom Milwaukee apartment.
Okay, it's not going to be here. And I'll show you the rest of the house.
It's Tuesday, and she won't see him until the weekend. He's a senior at Waukesha North High School, about 30 minutes away.
My son is a week at a time in Waukesha just to keep his grades up, to get to school every day on time and not dragged out tired.
Williams and her son lived in Waukesha until last August. She wanted him to finish high school there, where he played football well enough to earn a scholarship to Iowa State. But Williams relies on a Section 8 voucher to pay rent. She ended up in the program about 10 years ago after being diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer while homeless. Williams says finding landlords that accept Section 8 was always difficult in Waukesha.
Some people said, oh, we don't accept rent assistance. And I'm like, why? Well, they tear up our units and it's hard to get them out. I'm like, okay, so I moved to the next unit. We don't accept rent assistance. Move to the next one. No rent assistance. It was really, really, really hard.
Williams had her rent assistance transferred to Milwaukee, even though it would mean uprooting her son's life. The search there was just as challenging.
You're kind of like desperate to find something. And so you kind of begin to settle. And that's the process of having rent assistance.
It becomes a thin veil for racial discrimination.
That's Margaret Rosga. She's been advocating for fair housing in Milwaukee for more than 50 years. Rosga took part in 200 nights of marches in the city for open housing in 1967 and 68. She eventually married one of the men who led them, Father James Grappi. She says the ability of landlords to turn away Section 8 recipients is a loophole in the civil rights law they fought for. That's why she's supporting a county proposal to ban rent assistance discrimination.
Giving people who have vouchers some way to get out of neighborhoods of high poverty concentration where the rents aren't actually cheaper.
Nearly 1,800 people in Milwaukee County received the vouchers, and almost three-quarters are people of color. County Supervisor Marina Dmitrievich introduced the discrimination ban and says feedback she's heard from the opposition is based on stereotypes.
Those tenants. I don't want to take Section 8 because of those things.
Ron Hegwood is a landlord and president of the Apartment Association of Southeastern Wisconsin. He says he understands the desire to desegregate, but he points out that rents for Section 8 recipients are capped by neighborhood. He says that puts landlords and other renters at a disadvantage.
We all want to live where we want to live, but if you can't afford to live there, you have to go with the choices you have. I mean, you're putting in a law in effect to create a protected class at everybody else's expense, and I think that's wrong.
Landlords also say they've had bad experiences getting reimbursed for damage done to units. Hegwood says if the ordinance passes, the association will lobby state legislators. Corey Schneider-Perigini knows the measure won't be enough to undo the segregation in Milwaukee's neighborhoods. She's with the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council and helped craft the proposal.
It's about, you know, where our kids are educated. It's about our correctional system. There's so many components to segregation, but this is one area, I think, where we can start to have an effect.
Housing advocate Margaret Rosga agrees it's a small step, but she says that's all the more reason to take it. Ximena Condi, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Ideas Network Director Cheryl Gasser. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us.